We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
This is Focus from Illinois Public Media on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. Harriet Williamson is the producer of Focus and our technical director in this hour, Jason Croft. Today we're going to look into the culture of Jewish cooking in the Midwest. Its history stretches back to a time when European settlers referred to this space as out west. Immigrants brought with them old foodways, but they also adapted their heritage using ingredients they found here, items like corn and cranberries. Anthropologists Ellen Steinberg and Jack Prost join us this morning. They're the authors of From the Jewish Heartland, Two Centuries of Midwest Foodways. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And the email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Both of our guests have written about the anthropology of foods. Ellen Steinberg is the author of Learning to Cook in 1898, a Chicago culinary memoir. Jack Prost is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And they will be here in Champaign-Urbana to take part in the second annual Off the Page Summer Book Festival at the Alana Union Bookstore on Friday, this Friday, June 10th, 2011. More on that later in the program. Listeners, I look forward to hearing from you, 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu. Ellen Steinberg and Jack Prost, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Celeste. We're fine, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Where I would like to start is by having the two of you tell us about the cookbooks you came across in the course of your research.
I think the thing that started our interest in manuscript cookbooks is actually centered down in Champaign. I stumbled on a box at the Old Main Bookshop in 1999 when I was down at Mom's Day for my daughter. And in that box of diaries and memoirs was a handwritten cookbook written by a woman named Irma Rosenthal Frankenstein, who was born 3 months before the Chicago fire and lived her entire life in Chicago in the North Kenwood Hyde Park area. And the cookbook was so fascinating that, as one thing usually does, it led to another, and we became inadvertent collectors of cookbooks. The second cookbook that we collected in the Jewish food area, we purchased on eBay, and it turned out when we were researching it that that cookbook had been written by a woman in St. Louis whose name was Ruth Ginsburg Dooney. Initially, we thought her initials were Mrs. LFD, but that was because I misread the L, the old-fashioned script L, and it really was an I. So again, as one thing led to another, we looked into the history, Ruth's history, and contacted one of her granddaughters, who told us, who was wonderful about sharing pictures of her family and who told us a lot of her family history.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about Ruth Dooney. Who was she?
Ruth, well, I have to go back one generation, really. Ruth's father, Mendel, was from Lithuania, and he came to Marietta, Ohio, around 1900. Probably to escape from the pogroms and the persecutions that were going on in Lithuania at that time. He was a grocer, and established a small grocery in the oil and gas boom town of Marietta. He saved for 3 years and brought over his wife, Jenny, and his children to Marietta around 1903. Ruth was the oldest. She was born around 1893, I believe. And once she was out of school at age 16, she, for some reason or another, she and her sisters, Rena and Ruby, moved to St. Louis, where they became shop girls and working as stenographers and so forth. Ruth married another Lithuanian immigrant named Isidore F. Dooney, and they had two children, Annette and Bernice. For some crazy reason, they moved to Hillsboro, Illinois. You know, we can't figure out why, but probably because Isidore could find a job there. There was no Jewish community that we could find in Hillsboro, Illinois. And subsequently, between 1920 and 1928, at some point, they moved back to St. Louis. And Isidore died in 1928, and Ruth started working again, selling hose and gloves at an upscale Jewish-owned department store in the city.
Yeah. Jack, what was their life like circa 1920 in Hillsboro? Do you have any sense of that?
There's a kind of a problem. They moved there. We had an information on what their address was because we had the census. But when we went there, and I can't tell you how many hours we spent in the basement of their city hall and looking at these old, moldy records that they had, we knew where they lived. We tracked that down. I think it was a newspaper office, and they had lived above that. And I think they had a dry goods establishment on the first floor, and then they were living up above. It's a newspaper office now, and there was newspaper records above. And so we asked the people at the newspaper if they had ever heard of anybody like that, or was there a Jewish community in the city? And they had no knowledge, no record. And we even finally, after all kinds of searching through everything and not being able to find any record whatsoever, they finally humorously suggested that there was an older lady at a elderly person's home that we should call. And we called her, but got the impression on the phone that not only did she not remember them, but may not have been able to remember other things as well. So the end result is we came back from Hillsboro with absolutely no sense of what the impact was of them being in that community. However, we did have very good information about what was going on in St. Louis before they went to Hillsboro and after they came back. But we have very little information on what went on in Hillsboro.
Yeah. It had to have been a lot easier to keep with your faith and your customs in a city like St. Louis as opposed to Hillsboro.
Yeah, well, Hillsboro wasn't so far away, so
yeah.
We suspect they went back and forth frequently.
I might
make a comment, though,
yeah.
Because your question raises an interesting subtext to this book. And it was Ellen's idea that what we should try to do is look at the history of food through the eyes of the actual people. If we could get their own words, their own writing at the time, try to look at history from the point of view of the people that lived it rather than someone else's interpretation of what the history was. And I was very interested as we went along with all of the people that we quote and whose recipes we use and so forth, to see to what degree the history that we have when told by the people fits with the classic history you would get in a food and culture history book. And it was surprising how close, in many cases, it came, but how far away it is was in a few where real people just aren't living sometimes the way the textbooks say they should be.
Also, a work like this where you're finding and investigating primary sources from people who, you know, they were living the life, and they, through these records, have something to say. They have left us something about their history and our history.
These were real people,
right?
And history so often, in my opinion, focuses on the big men and the important people, and oftentimes just neglects to look at what ordinary people were doing, what ordinary people were thinking, what ordinary people were working at. And when you look at what the ordinary people were doing and thinking and cooking, you sometimes get a very different perspective on life and time. For example, in some of the cookbooks, the manuscript cookbooks, we have things like war cakes. Well, war cakes were cakes that were made primarily during World War I and then again during World War II. But just by the name, you can put them in a historical context. I don't think that you would find reading in a normal history book about World War I mention of war cakes and how the ordinary people were coping with the shortages that they had to cope with when they were cooking. And yet the cookbooks that we have, the manuscript ones, clearly demonstrate that during the war, you know, they shifted from using a lot of butter and from using a lot of eggs to, you know, conserving butter and eggs. And so the recipes reflect the efforts to conserve and do their patriotic duties.
Well, let me break in and say something that Ellen won't say, but I think I'm allowed to say it. The cookbook that we had from the woman who lived in Chicago, named Irma, she had a husband who was very active, very prominent in University of Chicago affairs, hospital affairs. He was a doctor. Her son was very prominent as a musician. She served food to Carl Sandburg. He lived in their home. Her son helped with the music stuff on his songbook, and she was active in every society you could name that was trying to do good and so forth. But when Ellen found the books down in Champaign, she asked the man who ran the bookstore, well, what are these? And he said, oh, a bunch of diaries. And she said, oh, you know. And he said, don't worry, nobody famous. You know, and what kind of bothers me is here's the woman who raises the son that helps Carl Sandburg do one of the most famous song books, is serving food, going to University of Chicago, prominent in her community, but always as vice president, not president of some association. And, you know, the end result is, you know, your life is sold for $10 and you're nobody famous. And, you know, somehow there's something missing in our story of history when the people who really are doing the work are just nobody famous.
Yeah. Well, here I'm thinking of, you mentioned Irma, and then we've talked a little bit about Ruth Dooney, and then there's also in your book information about a cookbook, a handwritten cookbook, recipes written down by a Midwestern Jewish farm woman.
Oh, yes.
So you get a very interesting cross-section of the life and experiences, the lives and experiences of people, and,
right.
and their similarities and their differences.
Yes, we were lucky, beyond lucky, to find two cookbooks written by Midwestern Jewish farm women. And the intriguing part in both of those was the huge emphasis on remedies and recipes for health and for common diseases and maladies like rheumatism and dyspepsia, which dyspepsia can cover any multitude of stomach problems. And we found that those were fascinating because they told us a lot about what people had to do to make themselves feel better in the age before antibiotics and, you know, effective patent medicines, what people who were far away from any supply of patented medicines could do to try to make themselves feel better and try to keep their families healthy.
Mm.
In the book, the one book that a farm woman wrote, there's a whole lot of recipes for candy. And we weren't sure whether she had a sweet tooth or whether or not those recipes for candy were just to give herself an energy boost at the end of the day, because looking at other material in terms of what farm women had to do on the farms, I don't think I could have accomplished an eighth of what they had to do every day. And I certainly know that if I had to sew my family's clothes, my family would be running around naked.
This is Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn, and this hour we're looking into the culture of Jewish cooking in the Midwest. Its history stretches back a very long way to a time when European settlers referred to this space as Out Wests. Two guests are with us this morning. They are Ellen Steinberg and Jack Prost. They are the authors of From the Jewish Heartland, Two Centuries of Midwest Foodways. The book is published by the University of Illinois Press. And our guests will be here in Champaign-Urbana to take part in the second annual Off the Page Summer Book Festival at the Illini Union Bookstore on this Friday, June 10th, 2011. And I promised earlier in the program that I'd give you the details. Friday, June 10th, from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m., Ellen Steinberg and Jack Prost will be in the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore to talk about this book that we're discussing this morning, From the Jewish Heartland, and they will be happy to meet you. So if you're in the area and you're interested in this topic and you'd like to meet our guests, Ellen Steinberg and Jack Prost, Friday from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m., June 10th, 2011, they will be participating in the Illini Union Bookstore's Off the Page Summer Book Festival. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. And you can also join us by email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a listener who is joining us on the phone in Urbana on line one. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Something I'm uncertain about. I've lost it somewhere. It's interesting. Are you talking about published books or notations people put together and put a clip on or stapled it and passed it around? I mean, are these actual published books?
Good question.
The books that we call manuscript cookbooks were handwritten cookbooks, very similar to... Well, a lot of women would put together a cookbook with favorite recipes, or in Irma Rosenthal, Frankenstein's case, she was getting married in 1898 and suddenly realized that she didn't know how to cook. So she asked her mother and some of her mother's friends for their recipes, and she wrote them down in a little notebook. Generally, the books that we were looking at were handwritten pages. Sometimes they had some clippings from newspapers stuck in them. They were attributed to other women, for the most part, or mama, or sister, or aunt. They were just homemade cookbooks.
So you're really talking about sharing recipes in a community, and they would be passed around.
I don't know if they would pass these particular manuscript cookbooks around. These were not like the cookbooks that sisterhoods, for example, put together for fundraisers. These were personal copies of recipes that the women put together for their own references.
Yeah, I'm not being fussy, but when you talk about a book, you think of a bound book. These are not bound books.
No, and that's why we call them manuscript cookbooks.
Is that the title of the book that you wrote?
No. What? The title of the book that we wrote is called From the Jewish Heartland, 2 Centuries of Midwest Food Waste.
Oh, that's very nice. Okay, well, I'm listening with great interest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this morning. Well, what about published cookbooks, what you refer to in From the Jewish Heartland as commercial cookbooks?
Yes. We consulted those, too, to see how the recipes that were handwritten into these women's notebooks compared to ones that were put down, you know, in a commercial publication.
Yeah, I think a major point is sort of gotten lost here, and that is what we tried to do is get the kind of manuscript, we call them foodway diaries, the kind of manuscripts that you had in your house. They were yours personally, because on these they would make all kinds of notations about things happening to their life. So-and-so called, they would write down the phone number. In other words, these were available in their kitchen. They were things they wrote to themselves. And that's why they end up having so much information about their own life. They would have information about a baby being born, problems with economics because of the Depression. So from these kind of manuscript foodway diaries, we can get a feel for what their life was like as it proceeded along during their lifetime.
Hmm. One of the things that I have at home is a typewritten recipe that my grandmother on my mother's side handed down to us. And it's one of the things that I really treasure among my recipes, and I've never made it. It's too much. It's too much work. But it is fascinating, and in it, I remember her from that, and I think that's the kind of lady she was. That's the kind of woman she was. She was very precise, and she gave us some tips on the side. It's lovely.
You're lucky to have that.
Yeah.
So many people never bothered to write down their recipes, or family members never bothered to ask. One of the women we interviewed, Judy Dworkin, whose family came from Eastern Europe, White Russia and Poland, said that her grandmother never allowed anybody into her kitchen. And so consequently, a lot of the recipes that they enjoyed eating were lost when her grandmother died.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, my mother never saw the inside of a kitchen, so I don't have family recipes to pass along to my children. And the ones that I pass along are cheese noodles and hot dogs, which they happen to like a lot. But, it's sad in a way that a lot of these old recipes are gone forever.
Yeah. On my father's side, my grandmother she didn't use recipes. She'd come from Ireland as a girl. She didn't use recipes, and I remember she showed me some things in the kitchen, but I was too little to really know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't remember it, and I really was too young, and but boy, I wish I had her bread recipe.
Yeah. I regret very much that I never spent a whole lot of time with my children's grandmother learning how she made certain things, because she was really a superb cook. And the one recipe that I did get from her was for sweet and sour meatballs. I swear she didn't tell me the real trick, because my sweet and sour meatballs almost poisoned everybody who ate them. There had to have been something she didn't tell me,
yeah,
for whatever reason. So those recipes are gone. And the other thing that we find, when we go out to flea markets or estate sales or used bookstores, we look for these kinds of handwritten notebooks with recipes in them. And we often wonder, how is it that they ended up here? Wouldn't you think that the family members would have wanted them and kept them, because they're real treasures? But, you know, you never know the circumstances behind how they end up where they end up.
Well, I think one of the secrets are people don't have a clue as to how lush these recipe books might be, these handwritten books, because as you pour through them, you find all kinds of information that can help you reconstruct who they were and some of what their life was. And part of the reason for this book is to suggest to people who might have these from their grandmothers or their bubbies or great-grandmothers, how they might go about reconstructing something about their lives from the record that they actually have handwritten in front of them.
What is the earliest manuscript that you have?
I think that would be Irma Rosenthal Frankenstein's, which was written in 1898, and which we can document was written then. Generally, with the Jewish cookbooks that we have, they're early 20th century to maybe mid 20th century, because that's when the largest influx of Eastern European Jews came over here. I'd love it if we could find some, you know, from the early 1800s, but no such luck yet.
Hmm.
We'll keep looking.
Yeah. You do take us all the way back to the 18th century, 1761, and a fellow by the name of Ezekiel Solomon. Now, there's no cooking manuscript, if I'm recalling correctly here, but he arrived in North America and settled in what is now Michigan in 1761.
Yeah.
What is known about him, and why did he push so far west?
He was a trader, a fur trader, and he lived or divided his year up between Canada and Michigan. He traded as far south as Cahokia, Illinois. And, you know, the fur trade was an extremely lucrative business at that time. I believe he had his fur trading business and lived within what was a British fort in Michigan at that time. And we can tell from the archaeological record at a nearby fort what people were eating during that period of time. And so we can assume that Ezekiel Solomon was probably eating similar foods, and that the British would have brought cows with them, and that they baked bread in a brick oven in the fort, and probably shot wild game and fowl at that time, and maybe traded with the Indians for corn. We really have very little information about Ezekiel Solomon.
Where had he come from? Do you know that?
I believe he came from Germany originally. other than that, we aren't even sure if his name was Ezekiel Solomon. Some records call him Ezekiel Solomons with an S at the end, and others call him Ezekiel Solomon.
Yeah. One of the points you make at the outset of the book is that Midwesterners, when asked, will often identify ourselves by both ethnic and religious descent, but it can be a different story for Jews, particularly those from Eastern Europe with no national ties. And maybe here we could talk about the differences and similarities of the heritage or the heritages of the Sephardic and the Ashkenazic.
Sure. You said that your grandmother came from Ireland,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
You would say I'm Irish, maybe Catholic, or
right.
Irish Protestant?
Yep.
Okay, so you hyphenate your heritage.
Right.
Okay, you find some Germans say I'm a German, and then Lutheran is understood, so to speak. With German Jews, they might say, well, we're German Jewish. With Eastern European Jews, what we found was a little bit different. When they came through the immigration portals to the United States, a lot of times their country of origin was not listed. They were just listed as Hebrew or Jewish, as if that were what they were, totally. The Sephardi were never numerous in the United States and never numerous in the Midwest. They were here early on, but they just were not here in great numbers. The largest group of Sephardic Jews we found historically were in Chicago and then down in Indiana. And that was not really even all that long ago that they were coming from Macedonia over to Indiana. Really, the differences were in some of their cuisine. The Sephardic cuisine tended to be, let's say, Greek, Southern Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, that reflected where the Sephardi were living and before they immigrated to South America or even Mexico and then the United States. Whereas the Ashkenazi cuisine reflects where the Jews lived within Europe, Russia, and Northern Europe, Central Europe, Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, and Western Europe. It's more the meat and potatoes kind of cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's a good way to describe it.
It's kind of fun to read through the book and discover that, in fact, everywhere anybody passed, whether they were Jewish or German Lutheran or a Catholic or whatever, wherever they were living, they pick up, even the earliest recipes we have in history, 5,000 years ago, Sumerian recipes, they borrowed some Akkadian who were living to the north. So every cookbook we look at, that you talk to your neighbors, you meet other people in some group, and they have a recipe you like, and you pick it up. And what it turns out is that the foods that you have in these books are a collection of things you've gotten wherever you've been. And it's almost impossible. The Lithuanian Jews, the German Jews, the Polish Jews, you can tell by their book the undercore of what they have, but, the Lithuanian Jews were eating Lithuanian food and the German Jews were eating German food. The intriguing thing is when they got to the Midwest, they began looking at the variety of vegetables and fruits and so forth we have here. They started having recipes for those.
Mm.
So that everywhere you go, you tend to look at the foods that are there and incorporate them into your recipes, your diet.
And what about the adoption of what we think of as Jewish food by others, Irish immigrants, German Protestant immigrants, on and on?
Well, I think, Irish immigrants at their core had an English cuisine, which at its core was German. So it wasn't much of a, you know, a change or a shift. It was a lot of meat and potatoes, corned beef, briskets, and so forth, which would not be foreign to Ashkenazi Jews in the Midwest. I think what happened once Jewish people got to the United States was that a lot more sugar got put in the diet, because mm-hmm. sugar was not very expensive, and a lot more fruits and perhaps dairy products were added. Obviously, they could afford, more than likely, beef more frequently than in Europe, especially if they were very poor peasants in Europe. So you see an expansion, I think, of the foods, the variety of foods, and the foods that these early Jewish migrants would add to their repertoire in the Midwest.
Are there certain hallmarks of a Jewish recipe?
Matzah. I mean, that's basically how we determined that a cookbook that we bought, a manuscript notebook, was written by a Jewish woman. In general, these were women. Written by a Jewish woman was because they had recipes in there for matzah this and matzah that. And matzah is what you would eat unleavened bread at Passover and other times of the year, but primarily at Passover. And in general, you don't find a whole lot of non-Jewish people putting in recipes for matzah cake and matzah pfannkuchen and other matzah-based dishes.
Mm. Well, it's not just matzahs. You could tell by the recipes that they had collected they were following a certain kinds of food laws. Mm-hmm. And second, they always had a certain recipes for holiday foods that would be characteristically Jewish instead of Catholic or so forth.
This is Focus, our topic this morning, the culture of Jewish cooking in the Midwest. Our guests are Ellen Steinberg and Jack Prost. They're the authors of From the Jewish Heartland, Two Centuries of Midwest Foodways. More after a short break.
If we're ever going to replace gas guzzlers with electric cars, science writer Seth Fletcher says we'll need batteries that will take us up to highway speeds and last a few hundred miles. They'll be made of lithium.
That's what you want out of a battery. You want to be able to pack as much energy in the lightest object possible.
On the next Fresh Air, Fletcher talks about his new book, Bottled Lightning. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, you didn't just read the cookbooks you collected. You cooked from them. You cooked from these manuscripts. What was that experience like?
Some were real disasters. A lot of the recipes were what we would consider today partial recipes, incomplete recipes. And that's understandable for a number of reasons. One, more than likely, the person who was writing down the recipes would have been standing right at the elbow of the person who was cooking the recipe. And since she knew what went next and so forth, she took shortcuts when writing it down. But, you know, historically now, looking back, we have very little idea of what went between. Another thing was, you know, butter the size of an egg or cook in a quick oven. Those kind of measurements or, you know, temperature notations would mean very little to somebody trying to cook those recipes today. Luckily, on the Internet, someone has gone through and figured out that butter the size of an egg is about 2 ounces, and in a quick oven means, something like 400 degrees Fahrenheit. It still doesn't mean that you can't have disasters. We tried to make something called brown cookie. Now, we didn't have any idea what kind of cookies those would be until we saw the batter. And then we realized that those were probably bar cookies that would end up being like a cake. And that, in all truth, it was a gingerbread cake that was being made. One of my disasters was the Pfannkuchen, which is in our book, and I think I made 5 different versions of that before I came up with one that was, one, palatable, and two, looked like a pancake was supposed to. And even then, it was so bland that my taste tester had to put jam or honey or powdered sugar on top.
Yeah. So our tastes change over
time. Our tastes have changed. Yeah. And then, because we're dealing with partial recipes a lot of the time, there's a lot of experimentation involved.
Well, I did all the tasting, and I can assure you that some of those old recipes were unbelievably tasty and good. So,
for example, Jack?
Well, the one that I really remember is grape pie. Ellen cooked Irma's grape pie for me one time, and this is at the top of the list. I have never tasted such a delicious pie in my entire life. It was unbelievable.
But the problem was, we didn't know what kind of grapes would have been used in the pie. And then we figured, well, she was a Midwesterner, and the Midwest grapes are generally Concord grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, finding Concord grapes in the local grocery store was nearly impossible. We had to go to a small Italian specialty fruit and vegetable dealer to get Concord grapes. And then when we got them, we didn't realize that if we didn't use them right away, they would ferment.
Oh, yeah.
So that was another, I mean, these things were learning experiences for both of us. Yeah. But then when we made the grape pie, it said something about tapioca, and I was I'm admitting to my ignorance. I was unfamiliar with the kind of tapioca that would be used, and I didn't know that it wasn't your instant tapioca pudding. And so that was another disaster. But the grape pie, when I finally got it together, was superb. And it smelled just like Welch's grape jelly that you open up and you first get that smell of real grape.
Yeah.
The pie was unbelievably rich and wonderful when we finally got the recipe down.
Yeah. We have grapes, we have Concord grapes growing in the yard, we have made jam from them. It's a lot of work, mm-hmm. but boy, it's like nothing you can get at the store.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I'm thinking also there are some other things here that you've got. In the appendix, you have an appendix where you have taken some of these recipes and so that we can try them out at home. And here's one that sounds really great to me. I lost it here. Maybe it was before the... No, I'm sorry. It's not in the appendix, but it's cold raspberry cream soup. That's got to be good.
Oh, that's Ethel Doris's fruit soup. Ethel Doris Grace is a very famous cook up in Minnesota and very interesting woman, around 90 years old and sharp as a tack. And she has traveled throughout the world taking cooking lessons and then converting them to kosher. Ethel Doris learned to make wild rice soup from the Chippewa Indians up in Hibbing, where she grew up.
Yep.
And she learned how to make fried gefilte fish balls simmered in tomato sauce from her Italian neighbor. And, you know, she's an amazing cook. But she shared with us her recipe, which I should find.
It is on page 153.
Okay. She shared with us her recipe for cold raspberry cream soup. That's expensive, again, to make, but well worth the expense. You can make it ahead, and it will keep for a couple days. It includes frozen raspberries and also a pint of fresh raspberries, raspberry yogurt, bananas cut in chunks, milk, sugar, cinnamon, half and half, raspberry liqueur, and you just whip it up in your blender and then strain it through a fine sieve and let it cool in the refrigerator overnight, and it is probably the most wonderful hot summer day soup that you can think of.
Yeah, perfect for a day like today where it's already 92 degrees.
Exactly.
And this would be a smoothie from heaven.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. We're running down on time, and before we finish, I would like one of the two of you to share with us some of the memories of Ruth Dooney's granddaughter, Carol Christian, which you've included in the book. Would you like to read an excerpt from what you recorded?
Sure.
Ellen has a book.
I have the book right here. So. this is Carol Christian, who we contacted about her grandmother on Ruth Dooney. And Carol wrote back, "Grandma was born in Lithuania, in a town she always called, and I'm probably butchering it, Kupichnik or Kupichik. Her family fled the Russian pogroms. A story I remember her telling was that once when their village was being attacked, her mother told her to grab a chicken and run. I honestly don't know how the family ended up in the Midwest. Grandma Dooney was a very sweet, humble woman who lived simply, always lit the Shabbos candles, went to synagogue, etc. All of us, including Grandma D, usually went to my paternal grandmother's house for the Jewish holidays because they had a real dining room, which she didn't, as well as the funds and the help to prepare all those lavish meals. And that's the thing. Jewish food is not cheap to make. And keeping a kosher kitchen is an added expense."
Mm. "And how did she do that in Hillsboro?"
Yeah, right.
We can't figure out.
Really can't figure out, except maybe Ruth traveled back and forth to St. Louis and picked up kosher meat, perhaps as so many other people did who lived outside of an area where they could get kosher meat. They had it delivered by the U.S. mail trains, where sometimes things, you know, spoiled en route, or they did without, or they waited until a ritual slaughter came around to some of the smaller communities and butchered their beef and poultry for them.
And for our listeners who might not be familiar with Hillsboro, it's sort of in between Springfield and St. Louis. Was there, a path through there from St. Louis through Hillsboro to Springfield?
You know, we don't know. We followed the highway. But actually, it was more common to go from Alton, Illinois, to Hillsboro, Illinois, that route back and forth, because that was the route that farmers took to take their grains, their wheat and their corn, over to Alton for processing and then shipment, probably down the Mississippi. But I'm sure that there was a railroad going through. Hillsborough is the county seat, Montgomery County mm-hmm. seat.
Yeah.
So it would have some kind of transportation yeah. in the early 1900s.
Yeah. I'd love to talk about preserving meat once you had your hands on some kosher meat, how you kept it if you needed to keep it around for a little bit, how you preserved it. But we're here at the end of the time. I do want to ask you for a closing thought. What would you like to leave us with this morning?
Well, I think our closing thought would be, besides buy the book, that Jewish food was food that Jews ate wherever they were in the world. And the traditions that they brought with them to the Midwest, they adapted to take advantage of the bounty that they found here in terms of fruits and vegetables and meat and poultry. Mm. That would kind of sum up what I would think.
Jack?
Women everywhere in the world are concerned with the health of their family, the economics of their family, and the desirability of the food they cook. And this came out in every single cookbook that we looked at, or every single diary that we looked at.
Mm. Fascinating topic, and thank you so much for joining us this morning. Really interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ellen Steinberg and Jack Prost have been our guests this morning. They are anthropologists. They're the authors of From the Jewish Heartland, 2 Centuries of Midwest Foodways. The publisher is the University of Illinois Press. They'll be in Champaign-Urbana for a book reading Friday from 5 to 6 p.m., June 10th, 2011. They will be in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. It's part of the second annual Off the Page Summer Book Festival at the bookstore, which is located on Wright Street in Champaign.